Dr. Albert Wu, broadcasting for WHO Patient Safety. And this is our session number 5 out of a total of 8 And today's topic is identifying solutions and also implementation. I should make one brief announcement, and that is that there is now a password secure website where you can download previous sessions. I am broadcasting simultaneously on GoToMeeting and on Doodle. So particularly for those of you who are seeing me on camera on Doodle, please forgive me if I look away. It means that I'm trying to find the correct button on the other computer. And if there are brief pauses, again, please forgive me. So a little overview of today's session. In order to improve patient safety, solutions are needed that tackle, that address the underlying causes of unsafe care. In this session, we will explain how we can use research methods to identify effective solutions. Again, we are focusing on research, not necessarily on clinical practice. Using research methods appropriately implies that we need to use appropriate research designs to test whether or not these solutions are indeed effective. And we're going to discuss briefly how to implement solutions. You have seen this cycle before. It should begin to look very familiar to you. These research in patient safety, including measuring harm, understanding causes, identifying solutions, evaluating impact, and translating evidence into safer care. We devote at least one session in this course to each of these numbers, and today we're going to be mostly talking about identifying solutions. So before we get going, a short quiz. This is a pre-test, and we will be reviewing the answers to these questions at the end. But you can perhaps try to keep these in mind, too, as we go through the lecture. Question 1. Patient safety interventions can be aimed at healthcare workers, B, patients, C, hospital units, D, all of the above. Question 2. Which of the following statements is false for clinical trials? They provide strong evidence for the efficacy of interventions. Sorry, there's an extra the in your doodle slide. B. Always focus on clinical outcome variables. C. Can control for unmeasured confounders. And D, are not always acceptable to clinicians. So which one of those statements is false? Question 3. 1, randomized double-blind clinical trial, controlled trial. 2, cross-sectional direct observations. 3, cluster randomized clinical trial. D, open or unblinded randomized trial. Question 4, which of the following patient safety interventions could be studied using a clinical trial? A, a new antibiotic regimen to reduce surgical wound infections. B, a team training intervention. C, a checklist to prevent catheter-related bloodstream infections. or D, all of the above? And final question, it is easier to implement a safety intervention if you, A, get hospital leaders to endorse the intervention, B, explain that the intervention is very inexpensive, C, educate healthcare workers about the intervention, D, answers A and C are correct. So let's get on now to the lecture. When the study that you're doing is really just for discovery, you're not sure yet what the solution might be. And so you're testing things, but you don't know if any of them are efficacious or effective. You could use a pre-post design. You could use a randomized, double-blind, controlled trial design, though sometimes double-blind, blinding the participants or the clinicians is difficult in a clinical setting. Cluster randomization or other types of designs. You can also use quasi-experimental designs, but I won't dwell on that on this slide. Trying to implement. And what we're trying to do here is we're trying to get people to use this solution, and the intervention is to try to convince people that they should use a solution that is known to be effective. You then want to test whether or not that you can make that happen. There are quite a few practices that we know that are effective for almost everyone. For example, if you've had a patient who's had a myocardial infarction, in the hospital or even outside of the hospital, giving them aspirin is going to increase the probability that they will antibiotic treatment for bacterial pneumonia is efficacious, and if it is given relatively soon, perhaps within 8 hours of presenting to the hospital, it is likely to save the patient's life, more likely. Hand washing is a very sensible but also a clearly demonstrated effective intervention at reducing the incidence of all kinds of healthcare infections. Unfortunately, the compliance by healthcare workers with these interventions is often much less than you would want, or much less than you would even expect. Even in the United States, for quite a long time, the compliance with all of these was less than 50%. Where should we intervene? Well, in fact, as we know, there are many factors, there are many levels of the healthcare system where there can be hazards and where there are factors that can affect safety or create risk. These include at the level of the patient, the healthcare worker, the workplace. Intervene at any of those levels. We could intervene with patients or on healthcare workers. We could make changes to the workplace, and that could be the intervention, or we could try to make system changes on individual leaders or on policies or procedures. I thought it was worth presenting this figure, and this is the hierarchy of research evidence. This is not absolute, but in general, there are stronger designs, and there are designs that are less conclusive, that are not so strong. At the top of the pyramid are the strongest designs, and these include systematic reviews of many clinical trials, or occasionally systematic reviews of many cohort studies or other studies of slightly weaker design. But these take advantage of the benefits that you get from doing good randomized controlled trials, but tries to see if these can be replicated and how generalizable they are across different studies. Randomized controlled trials provide the strongest evidence that is available from an individual efficacy, that is whether or not a treatment works in well-controlled circumstances, delivered in a precise way by people expert in that delivery, often following a specific protocol. Cohort studies and other observational studies are not as strong a design, though sometimes they can provide better evidence on the effectiveness of treatments. That is because they often are able to include a larger number or a greater proportion of the whole population that is being studied. Case series, case reports, and editorials, expert opinions, are the weakest form of evidence. Interventions can be relatively strong. That is, if you apply the intervention, it is more likely to have a greater effect. And interventions can also be relatively weak. It's harder for them to work. This figure is from a paper just out in the Annual Review of Public Health. My disclaimer is that I'm the senior author on the paper. And this is not an absolute list, but weak interventions include simply telling nurses and doctors to try harder, be more careful. A slightly stronger is the intervention to get people to read back or repeat back information that is told to them. Please give 1 milligram of morphine, 1 milligram of morphine. The procedure of standardizing handover procedures when patients go from one doctor to the next, reducing workload, these are stronger still. Simplifying processes, computerized prescription order entry, checklists to make sure things happen. These are stronger interventions still. As you can see, these might make it harder or remove factors that can lead to errors. Automating procedures, forcing functions, which are procedures that make it very difficult to do the wrong thing. You have to do something special to do the wrong thing, are even stronger interventions. We're going to be talking about some of these kinds of interventions in the examples that I'm going to talk about now. Discuss a few classic studies, and if you go to the WHO patient safety website and click on the research button, there is a whole collection of cases of classic patient safety research studies. These are included with whole PowerPoint sets that describe the studies and include some quotations directly from the authors telling us what they experienced as they were doing the studies. We're going to talk about a randomized controlled trial with follow-up for 3 years of 850 patients. We're going to talk about a unblinded cluster randomized trial of a teamwork training intervention. And we're going to talk about a prospective intervention, mostly using a checklist, in 108 ICUs in 67 hospitals. This was not a randomized trial. So randomized controlled trials provide strong evidence for efficacy. They have the almost unique characteristic among research designs of being able to control for for unmeasured confounders, unmeasured confounding variables, because of randomization. This is not guaranteed when you conduct a clinical trial, but no other design has the possibility of doing this. Some disadvantages, or things to at least think about, clinical trials require the people participating to accept that this is something that they can do at that time in their setting. This is called equipoise. People need to be unsure whether or not a intervention is efficacious or not. If everyone thinks it should be done, then it's going to be hard to randomize people to a control. The illustration shows an example of a situation where a randomized trial has never been done. That is people jumping out of airplanes. The intervention is the parachute. There has never been a randomized controlled trial to test whether or not parachutes are efficacious at getting people safely to the ground. However, there's great reluctance for people to allow themselves to be randomized to the control group, and so this study has never been done. Well, it's difficult, in fact, sometimes to do clinical trials, and hard to get people to accept that this is something that they are willing to do. Clinical trials are not ideal for testing effectiveness because they are necessarily restricted to a limited sample. They are generally more expensive and time-consuming than other designs. They're not so good at looking for subgroups, looking at the subgroups who are enrolled in your study, unless you specifically stratify your randomization and select adequate numbers of patients so that you can test subgroups, and that you randomize people if they're in a particular subgroup. And usually you can only test one intervention at a time, whereas in other designs, like a cohort, you can look at the relationship of many interventions to the outcomes. Our first study is by Reggiore and colleagues. This was published in the British Journal of Surgery, and it's a study from Italian and African, Ugandan investigators who are working in a hospital in Uganda. If you want to get the full text article, you can get it by clicking on the links indicated. Background, post-operative wound infections and other deep infections are a major concern in developing countries. They lead to many deaths in sub-Saharan Africa. There have been, however, few studies of post-op infections. Maybe as high as 70% of surgical cases. Another issue is that antimicrobial resistance is an increasing problem. Penicillin is by far the most commonly used antibiotic in Uganda and in African district hospitals. There are also often not microbiologic culturing facilities, and so this is used empirically and not based on the results of of microbiological tests. A short course of a single dose of antimicrobial prophylaxis has been shown in other settings to be effective in reducing post-op wound infection. In developed countries, not in developing or developing countries or those with transitional economies. For example, ampicillin is a low-cost broad-spectrum antibiotic with quite a long half-life, a long enough half-life, and a high concentration in tissues. Metronidazole has anaerobic activity and a long half-life. Resistance to both of these is rare in rural Africa. So there are potentially a useful intervention. here's a test. The design was a randomized clinical trial. The objective is to compare the clinical effectiveness of conventional post-op penicillin with single-dose ampicillin for hernia repair and ectopic pregnancy. A second objective to compare the efficacy of conventional post-op penicillin with single-dose ampicillin plus metronidazole as prophylaxis for hysterectomy and C-section. And three, to measure the impact of different antimicrobial regimens on outcomes, including length of stay and cost of care. The study was a 150-bedded government hospital in rural Uganda, and it was sponsored by the International Service Volunteers Association. This hospital does 800 major surgical procedures a year. 35% are done on an emergency basis. It has 6 Ugandan and 2 Italian surgeons on staff. Interestingly, and I think this is important, they do not have microbiological facilities, at least patients 18 and over were admitted to the hospital for elective and emergency surgery between 1991 and 1993. Patients were stratified, divided into 2 categories. One of them, category 1, were patients who had hernia repairs and ectopic pregnancy. The second, abdominal hysterectomy and C-sections. They were randomly allocated to one or another of the courses of treatment, penicillin or the experimental regimen. These are the specific regimens that were given, and I won't go into these in detail. Ampicillin versus penicillin, ampicillin and metronidazole versus penicillin. You can see, however, that in this design, both standard treatment, penicillin, and the new treatment are standardized, and this is not actually always the case in usual practice. So data collection after the operation, each patient was assessed every day by 2 supervisors. These people were aware of what treatment the patient had gotten. They got follow-up 2 weeks after discharge. Wound infections were graded by inspection as superficial, deep, or throughout. Peritonitis was presence or absence of peritonitis was assessed, and length of stay and post-op outcomes were recorded. So some of the key findings. Ampicillin, the regimen with ampicillin, significantly reduced incidence of post-op infection versus the usual penicillin, from 7.5% for penicillin versus 0 for hernia, 10.7 versus 2.4% for ectopic pregnancy, 20 versus 3% for hysterectomy, 38 versus 15% for C-section. So more efficacious. Patients on ampicillin also had a significant reduction in length of stay, post-op mortality rates, and post-op complications from a standard list of complications after hysterectomy and C-section. In collecting these data, they used standard definitions for infections. They trained the observers in so that they would report similarly when confronted with similar types of wound infections. They used standardized data forms to collect these data so that they could be sure that they were getting the same information from patients in both groups. Some analyses of costs. I present these in particular because I think they're important for this setting. This may be particularly relevant to many of you listening. Average cost at the time, 1992, was $3 for an admission day, including personnel, drugs, and utilities. there were in fact cost savings with the new regimens. The ampicillin flagyl regimen was cheaper than full penicillin course, probably because it was only one dose. And the length of stay was shorter for both groups that got the ampicillin-containing regimens. Some main points. Well, first of all, it's worth repeating that post-op infections are common, but if anything, underestimated and underdocumented. High post-op infection rates can be reduced. And in this study, where they were observing carefully, they had pretty high infection rates, over 20%, in some cases, even using penicillin prophylaxis, but they can be reduced. And so they concluded that single-dose ampicillin prophylaxis, though at the time rarely used, was more cost-effective, and more effective for that matter, than standard penicillin treatment. Now this was quite a while ago, but this was a study that was done and could be done now. Some practical considerations: it did take 3.5 years to do the studies. It was mostly done within their own hospital budget, and a little bit was spent extra for incentives for patients and buying extra drugs. They did need a team member who had some statistical and epidemiologic expertise, and they used the clinical staff to provide the services. This study was approved by the Ethical Hospital Board, and this is important because it is not ethical to conduct all types of research. This is something which must be considered every time a study is considered. That is, whether or not it is in fact ethical to conduct the research for the individual patients who are in the study. The authors suggested that research is feasible and applicable in other developing countries. They said it is applicable everywhere because it is very simple, and the result is to, again, further simplify patient care. No technology or sophisticated items were necessary, including a microbiology lab. So here's a second study, and this was a study by Nielsen and colleagues. This was done in the US, and it was on the effects of teamwork training on adverse outcomes and the and processes of care in labor and delivery. Also a randomized trial, and you can link to the article itself, which was in Obstetrics and Gynecology. I present this mostly because it is actually a trial, though using a different design. And it's of a different kind of intervention, a teamwork intervention. The design was a cluster randomized trial. The intervention was a standardized teamwork training curriculum based on something called OCRM, that is crew resource management, which is used by military trainees mostly, people who are pilots, to make sure the crew works together as well as possible. The intervention emphasized communication and team structure. The objective was to evaluate the effect of teamwork training on the occurrence, the incidence of adverse outcomes, and to see if it could improve the process of care in labor and delivery. The setting was hospital labor and delivery units in 15 hospitals. These 15 hospitals included over 1,300 labor and delivery personnel, mostly doctors and nurses. The patient population, all women with a pregnancy, and 2004, there were a total of 28,000 deliveries in those hospitals. Data collection was completed for 94% of deliveries, and about 95% of deliveries in both control and the intervention hospitals. We're missing just a little bit off that slide there, sorry. But anyway, they got very good, very complete data collection, which is important. You particularly want to have similar follow-up in both arms of your trial. The design was a balanced masked randomization scheme at the hospital level. So the nurses had been trained, but the people who were trained did know it's hard to mask them. They assigned 7 hospitals to receive teamwork training and 8 in the control arm. So people who were the trainees were randomized within their hospitals. That was the cluster. And they balanced the two different type, they balanced hospitals so that they would have teaching hospitals, private hospitals, governmental hospitals, large hospitals, small hospitals, similar numbers in each of the two arms. Again, as I said, the personnel, the medical care staff, were not blinded to whether or not they had been trained or not. Not really possible to do. Now, staff from the intervention hospitals attended a training session, which was centralized. It was based on crew resource management. There was people went through actually more than a day worth of training. They then returned to their hospitals, and they trained the other staff at their hospitals in obstetrics, anesthesia, and nursing, because these are people who are working in labor and delivery. In the end, they had multidisciplinary teams who had been trained to work together, hopefully, in particularly obstetric emergencies and also just in general obstetric care. In a way, every, isn't it? They collected data for 2 months before teamwork training in both arms, and after implementation for 5 months after the teamwork curriculum was adopted in both the intervention and the control hospitals. All the training did occur after baseline data collection, so there was not so much contamination of those deliveries. Those deliveries should not have been affected by teamwork training because it hadn't happened yet. And data supervised and centrally trained data coordinators. So again, they were using standard methods, standard forms, and they had been trained so that they would collect the data in similar ways for all cases. This is, again, very important. Their outcome measures included an adverse outcome index, which was designed to reflect the proportion of all deliveries that had at least one bad outcome. This was their main outcome variable. The reason for this is that, in fact, fortunately, adverse outcomes were relatively infrequent in these hospitals for these patients. What were the findings? Well, first of all, there were no baseline differences between the patients in the two hospitals. So that was good. Randomization, even though it wasn't fully randomized, appeared to work in that way. Looking at their main outcome variable, the mean adverse outcome index score was similar in the control and intervention groups. In the control group, it was 9.4% adverse outcomes, and in the intervention group, it was 9%, so not so different. And after implementation of teamwork training, it was now 7.2% in the control group, actually lower. Significant differences. They looked at a lot of process measures, and only one of them, which is time from the decision to perform an immediate C-section to the incision, that was better in the team-trained group. It was shorter, 33 minutes in the control group and 21 minutes in the intervention group. It makes sense. I guess the team worked a little better in a relative emergency. Okay, we're going to do a C-section and off to the OR. They were a little bit more efficient, but this was really the only difference between the two groups. They did conclude that the team training could be done adverse outcomes as they had hoped. You could read more from the authors themselves if you go to the article itself, or for that matter, to the WHO patient safety website. The third and final study we're going to talk about is from Pronovost et al. And this was an intervention to decrease catheter-related bloodstream infections in the ICU. I present this because it's it really is a little bit of a classic case. I apologize because this is not from a developed, this is not from a developing country. The sad thing is that at the moment there have been relatively few of this kind of study in developing countries. That is in fact why many of you I think are tuning in. You are the future hope of us having some research studies like this done in done outside of the developed world. Briefly, catheter-related bloodstream infections in intensive care units are common, costly, and developing in intermediate and transitional, and countries with transitional economies also. In the U.S., there are probably at least 80,000 catheter-related bloodstream infections leading to 28,000 deaths every year at a great cost. Interventions are needed to reduce this hospital-acquired infection. And at the time of the study, it was not clear that this could be done on a wide-scale basis. Now, the study team had developed and implemented a program which had greatly reduced catheter bloodstream infections within our own hospital at Johns Hopkins. The question is, could this be applied to a whole state, which is as large as many small in area and in population as many small countries outside of the U.S. And had many hospitals who, in general, were not working together at this point. The design was a prospective intervention, but not a trial. They had an evidence-based intervention, and this was really a pre-post design to compare infection rates before, during, and 18 months after the intervention. The main hypothesis was that bloodstream infections would be reduced in the first 3 months of the intervention compared to baseline, and then it would be sustained over the year and a half of the study. The population was the patients of all hospitals in the state of Michigan, U.S., that had adult intensive care units. There were 108 of those in 67 hospitals that were enrolled. This represented 85% of all the ICU beds in the state of Michigan. And ICUs included medical, surgical, cardiac, mixed, neuro, surgical trauma, and in fact, one pediatric unit too. The intervention used really a checklist or a bundle, and it wanted to improve clinicians' use of five pretty simple evidence-based procedures, each of which was identified as being effective, and together they had been shown to have the greatest effect compared to other interventions of reducing catheter bloodstream infections. Also, they were chosen because they could be done. They were relatively easy to implement. The checklist or the bundle of services, the bundle of procedures was hand washing before procedures. Used around the insertion site, cleaning the skin with chlorhexidine, not just with alcohol, because chlorhexidine is a little bit better, avoiding using femoral placement sites because these are dirtier, and removing unnecessary catheters soon after they're placed, not leaving those catheters in for longer better than absolutely necessary. These things all make sense, but they were not followed for most patients in most of the hospitals that were studied. The ICUs also used a daily goals sheet. The purpose was to improve clinician communication within the ICU. What are our goals for this patient today? What are we trying to do? There was also an intervention at the same time to reduce ventilator pneumonia. So people were thinking about reducing infections quite a lot. And they also used a comprehensive unit-based safety program to improve the culture of safety in the hospital, or CUSP, C-U-S-P. I got a few questions over the last 2 weeks about how does one implement a program in a hospital. And this is a fairly comprehensive way that this was done to get these hospitals to a place where they were ready to do the intervention. The first thing that was done was there was an assessment of safety culture. This was done by survey, and the intensive care units in particular, also other personnel in the hospital, but especially the ICU staff, filled out a survey on safety attitudes, what they knew and what they thought about safety in their unit. The second is they got a brief course, a day course, on the science of safety. So they could understand in general, as you are doing, that safety is important, that when we talk about safety, it means that there are situations now when patients are not safe, when they are injured by care. The staff were asked to identify what they thought were safety hazards in their units, in their ICUs. What is a way that a patient will be harmed in the next week or month in my units? What things do I know about how things work so that indicate that this is a real hazard? Senior leadership in the hospitals were enlisted to work with the ICUs. They were partners, basically, and they came from their offices to the unit and participated so that people could see that top leadership in the hospital thought that safety was important. They tried to learn from the defects that were applied and were given tools to try to improve some of the problems that they detected, and then they surveyed people again. I don't expect you to read the data explicitly here off the figure, but this is from the paper, and the finding was both the mean and median CAT rates of catheter-related blood obstructions per 1,000 catheter days decreased significantly after the intervention from 2.7 at the start per 1,000 catheter days to a median of 0 at 3 months. The mean rate decreased from 7.7 infections to 1.4 infections per 1,000 catheter days. And many of these hospitals went for months and now even years without having any more catheter bloodstream infections. The conclusion was that a large-scale project focusing on reducing incidence is feasible. What was done was that the practice of clinicians was changed in these units, and the reduction can be large and sustained throughout at least 18 months. We now know that it's been sustained for several years in these units. This was also at a significant reduction in cost. It's been estimated that, in fact, millions of dollars were saved in these hospitals because patients didn't need to stay in the hospital so long. In translating evidence to practice, and we've started to talk about this just a little bit, especially in the last case, we need to develop both an intervention that we want to use to take that piece of evidence and make it be performed more reliably, and then we also want to evaluate what happened, because otherwise we don't know whether or not we're improving practice or not. So this requires understanding what the evidence really is, converting it into a checklist, for example, to know what the situation is in your unit or your hospital or your setting. No one knows that better than you, but you have to look systematically. And making sure you have measures to evaluate whether or not safety actually improved. You then want to pilot test the interventions and the tools in individual hospitals or individual countries. Again, just because something worked in one setting does not mean in any way that it'll work in another. So, in summary, I would say that we still need to learn a lot about effective interventions that can improve safety. We would still like to identify effective interventions for problems for which we don't have solutions yet. And this requires well-designed and well-conducted studies. Now, there are already some evidence-based procedures that aren't being used widely enough, and hand-washing is a very good one. Some of the elements of the safe surgery checklist, which WHO has developed, are also evidence-based and can be shown in individual hospitals to improve safety. But once this sort of intervention is implemented, it does need to be evaluated, adjustments need to be made, and it needs to be redeployed and evaluated again. Here are references to these studies that were described today, including a reference to the web-based comprehensive unit-based safety program, CUSP, which was published a few years ago. Here are also some additional resources. These are references to a team training curriculum. These are available from the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality. There is a website, innovations.arc.gov. AHRQ, as some of you know, is the lead patient safety agency in the U.S., of the U.S. government, and they have listed innovations, including things like the checklist that was described in the study. You can also go to safetyresearch.jhu.edu. This is the Quality and Safety Research Group at Johns Hopkins and describes a number of other tools and interventions. So let's review the quiz. Patient safety interventions can be aimed at healthcare workers, patients, hospital units. Well, we know that it can be aimed at all of them, though we talked really about healthcare workers and hospital units today. Which of the following is false for clinical trials? They provide strong evidence for efficacy. I'm sorry, I should have, for you on Doodle, A should say provide strong evidence for efficacy. They always focus on clinical outcome variables. Well, that's not correct. Clinical trials can look at costs, for example, which are not clinical outcomes. They can look at patient satisfaction or patient functioning, which are not clinical outcomes. They can control for unmeasured confounders. They're not always acceptable. All of those are true. So B, however, is false. Which of the following is not a design for a clinical trial? Well, a cross-sectional clinical observation or a series of cross-sectional clinical observations are not a clinical trial. They are only happening at one point in time and don't use the longitudinal design that's necessary in a trial. This is a legitimate research method on its own, as you know from earlier lectures. Which of the following can be studied using a clinical trial design. Well, all of those can be studied using a clinical trial design. And finally, five, it's easier to implement a safety intervention if you get hospital leaders to endorse the intervention. Absolutely. People are more likely to do things, a little bit more likely anyway, if they believe hospital leadership thinks it's important. And general clinicians don't necessarily care about that. So this is not really a way to make it much easier. I guess you could make an argument for this too. Educate healthcare workers about the intervention. Well, they certainly need to understand and believe in what they're doing. So I would say that the answer is D, A, and C. We have a few minutes remaining, and what we would like to do is take questions. The first question I would like to ask, unless you have your own questions, is what are the barriers in your own institution to implementing interventions of any kind to improve patient safety? What sorts of obstacles do you have that would make it harder for you, even if you knew that there was something that could improve safety? Like hand washing, like a safe surgery checklist, like a checklist to reduce bloodstream infection. I will actually go forward one more. I will just simply say, if you have any other questions, please post those across. What we will try to do for the next few minutes is answer some of your questions. We cannot get to them, I will try to answer them online as we did for the last couple of weeks. So that concludes the formal presentation for this, which is lecture 5 out of our series of 8 on patient safety research. But I would like to hear from you for at least the next couple of minutes, if you can, if you have any questions. In fact, what I would like Mai to do is, as she has done before, who is sitting in Geneva, can post some of the comments or questions on her screen. We will now, at least on GoToMeeting, be looking at some of those questions, and I'll try to discuss as many of them as I can. I do see one comment that says that CRM stands for customer relations. Maybe that's customer relations management. It does too. That's the problem with acronyms. But for the purposes of our study today, CRM also stands for crew resource management. And so the crew are people who might be on a flight deck in a helicopter or an airplane. The people are the resources, and you're trying, and there are, and the things they're working with are also resources, and you would like the crew to work together to manage their resources as well as possible. So let's see. Can we use the same prophylaxis regimes for all hospitals in a region? And that is, I think that's a good question. And the answer to Hossein's question is, I don't know. It depends. This one particular trial was done in the 1990s in Uganda in their hospital. And I do not know. Someone probably does know what the rates of resistance are in Ugandan hospitals in that province, across Uganda, and in other countries. But things do need to be tested to some extent. You need to collect at least some data before implementing a intervention. It's not really any more effective. It's really not any more acceptable to simply adopt the Michigan intervention, or for that matter, the Uganda intervention in your hospital without knowing a little bit about your setting first. Where can we access samples of patient of safety culture assessments? There are some good examples on the patient safety website. A very good safety culture assessment, perhaps the one that is used the most widely worldwide, is called the Safety Attitudes Questionnaire, the SAQ, and that is another good safety culture assessment. There's another question, what's the best tool to measure patient safety culture? So, Chisasi asks sort of a similar question, I'm not sure if it is either. We are just about to use the Safety Attitudes Questionnaire in a Gujarati hospital in India, and we're going to find out whether or not it's in rural India. We're going to find out whether it works particularly well or not. I'm not sure. The Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, AHRQ, has a safety culture or safety attitudes questionnaire also. It's a little bit more hospital focused, and it's possible that may be better. I think you need to look at it and then think a little bit, perhaps ask around your hospital to find out. In India, doctors always give workload as an excuse for implementing hand washing and checklists. How can we motivate them? I think that we often talk about sort of different steps that are necessary to motivate healthcare workers to change practice. Some of them are top down. In other words, we need the organization to say, we have a lot of infections in our hospital. They're caused by poor hand hygiene. Infections. This many people are dying because of wound infections or hospital infections, and these could be prevented. And so that's one thing. The other thing is you need to engage the interest of individual healthcare workers. One way of doing that is finding patient advocates, people who have developed wound infections and can talk about what the experience was and how terrible it was. That can help motivate people to want to prevent those sorts of things. Educating healthcare workers, education campaigns, and then making materials available for them so that they can actually do it, but is important too. If you can put hand washing stations or alcohol rub in many places, then it doesn't take so long. In many hospitals, people have a little bottle of alcohol-based hand rub in their pocket at all times, and before they see a patient and after they see a patient, they put a little on their hands and they rub them. I personally can say that I didn't used to be very good at washing my hands. But perhaps because I've worked at WHO, I have graduated. In fact, it is possible to do. It maybe adds a few seconds to my day. It does not. I don't have to scrub my hands for 10 minutes before and after every procedure. But a little bit of rub goes a long way. Is there an effective way of gathering data for monitoring hand washing? If you go to the WHO website, there are, and the first global patient safety challenge is cleaner cares, clean care saves lives, and there are many resources on how to implement better hand washing practice, including a very specified ways to monitor hand washing. So Janet, there are very well developed resources on how to gather data about monitoring hand washing. I think that you can, if you're talking about providing incentives for healthcare workers, I think that you can. Some of the incentives are, as I said, engaging them emotionally. Others can be things, small incentives like contests or campaigns. If you fill out this questionnaire about hand washing, you can be eligible to win a small prize in a raffle. You know, we'll take one name out of this box. So people fill out the questionnaire, and then they realize that they're not washing their hands so much. If you observe people not washing their hands, please submit a little report, and you can get potentially get a prize for doing that. You can initially they make it a game, but after a while, I think that it's not so necessary. So I think it's a good question, Ibrahim. In general, it's not necessary, but at the start, sometimes it can make it if you can make it more engaging. I think physicians do come to work believing that they come to work. Physician safety is a challenge because people do come to work to do a good job. But I think that if you think about it for a very short time, you realize that we do a lot of things that are efficiency focused rather than safety focused. And simply by giving examples of things that we do that are doctor centered or healthcare worker centered, they're there to improve our efficiency. And they're there to allow us to move more patients through. Now, those things are important, but we often do not think about safety at all. And simply by becoming aware that patient safety is an issue in the first instance is perhaps the first step. I think that the question is from Juan, do you need to validate a patient safety culture survey to be used for research in our institution in Peru? I think you should look at the survey. It is possible, depending on how well it matches issues that you know or can figure out in your hospital, that it may work fine, or it may need to be altered. So I can't tell you right away, but I think by examining the questionnaire, which should always be the first step, you can figure out whether or not it's likely to work or if you have real significant questions. I'm going to take this last question from Bruce. Most healthcare training to study and apply interventions is based on counting. Most problems we face are analytic. How might this be improved? I think that that's right. Most of what we know how to do in healthcare epidemiology is counting things, but we need to go with the next step. We, in fact, do not have don't have enough experience and don't have enough training in analysis. And in fact, the methods for analyzing data, either big, large amounts of data, or else qualitative data, are still limited. I think that by taking courses like this, you know, maybe this is just the start, but I think that what we need to do is to become better at not just collecting the data, but analyzing that. That's sort of the next step. We are going to talk a little bit about some of these issues in subsequent sessions. So Bruce, maybe if you do tune in, you could see if your questions are answered better at all at the end of this course or not. I think we should stop. We're just a few minutes over time, but thank you very much. This has been I think we certainly got some very good questions, and I hope to see many of you again in a week. Thank you all again. Take care. Bye-bye.